One, two, three, check, 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 check for you.
As usual, we'll have the recitation in Pali,
the
Mangala Sutra.
So
when the teaching of the Buddha was compiled, it was compiled firstly in Pali, and Pali tradition is the foundation of the teaching of the Buddha.
Yes.
It's 5 years ago at McLeod.
Right.
And then the Sanskrit tradition of the teaching, from which we'll recite the Heart Sutra,
Venam re, Korea re, and Nihon re, and then Perda, Sopo.
So from India, the Sanskrit tradition spread to China, Vietnam, Korea, Japan, and Tibet, and so forth. So the first day we'll have recitation in Pali and Sanskrit.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Iti piso bhagava arahaṃ samma sambuddho. Vijjācarana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarati saddha deva manussanam buddho bhagavati svakhato bhagavata dhammo sandiddhiko akaliko Siko opanahiko pachyattam veditam bhovinyo hiti supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho.
Have we heard this first Kala Chakra? Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Dhuryam pibu
Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you. Ta. Koso ngemba chita na. Nuish. Chikto da. Nje. Ya ya da. A pali.
So we have the recitation of the Mangala Sutra in Pali. So perhaps during the time of the Buddha himself, this must have also been recited. And in the Theravada countries like Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, and so Laos and so forth, also follow mainly the Pali tradition, and they have an excellent practice of the perfection of the Vinaya, the monastic discipline. Of course, there are a few who may misbehave even within these traditions, but on the whole, they have very good practice of Vinaya. So when I first visited Thailand, there was an old thera. The Sangharaja, that one passed away, and then there was a second one also who was really good and who was really inspiring faith, who inspired faith in me, and he also had passed away. And I received the picture of that Sangharaja. It was really, I had a special feeling. And then we had from children, these school children, reciting the Heart Sutra in Sanskrit. This is the first time. So with regard to the Sanskrit tradition of the Buddhism, it first went from India to China, from where it spread to Vietnam, Korea, and Japan. And then another strand of the Sanskrit tradition spread from India to Tibet, from where it spread to outer in Inner Mongolia, and then also the republics within the republics of Kamakhya, Tuva, Buryatia, within the Russian Federation. So when these children recited the Heart Sutra in Sanskrit, I felt that in this language, Sanskrit, so since the compilation, the Buddhist councils where the teachings of the Buddha were gathered, it's been maybe over 2,000 years or so. So with the Pali as a foundational teaching, then we have the Sanskrit tradition, which is based on reason and logic to establish the profound meanings, the essential meanings of the teaching of the Buddha through logic. And Buddhism first originated in India. And there was a decline in it, and today, now we have, over the recent times, we have people taking more interest in the teaching of the Buddha, and today we had some children reciting the Heart Sutra in Sanskrit. So the teaching of the Buddha, which has been it's been 2,600 years or so. So it's like today, with these recitations, it's like we are reviving. I mean, the Buddhism is being reborn, almost like. So I felt a mixed feeling of sadness and happiness. So, having the children having recited the Heart Sutra in Sanskrit, now, of course, in the Tibetan tradition, we also have the study of the Sanskrit, I learned it from my late tutor, Ling Rinpoche. But as Tibetans now, we don't have to resort to Sanskrit as such, thanks to the great master Abbot Chandrakshita, who established the teaching of the Buddha on the Tibetan soil. And in order for it to flourish well, then because the monastic community is considered very important, we had the first seven Tibetan children who were tested whether they could keep the Vinaya vows or not, and then they were ordained by Chandrakshita, who was himself a great philosopher and also a logician. And so, with regard to his philosophical system, he followed the Madhyamaka, the middle way philosophy. And then the way he taught with Madhyamaka was by using logic and reasoning. After Dignaga and Dharmakirti, the study of epistemology and logic and reasoning was continued by Chandrakshita, and then his student Kamalashila also served in the establishment of Buddhism on the Tibetan soil. And so, since we have the Tibetan language itself, Chandrakshita and advised the Tibetans to have the teachings of the Buddha in our own language, Tibetan, without having to resort to Sanskrit. And so we have over 100 volumes of the Kanjur, the translations, and then there are over 200 volumes of the Tengur. And so we are going to recite this Heart Sutra in Tibetan as well.
다 싫어 님고 다 용견지 뒤숨 다 가다 용세 줄든세
So with regard to the Heart Sutra we have the extensive the middle length and then also the short versions of perfection of wisdom and so there's also the 18,000 verses and so forth and within the this perfection of wisdom teachings the content could are those of the explicit content of emptiness and implicit content of the progression along the path such as the six perfections and 10 perfections and then also those of the bodhisattva paths and the resultant state of buddhahood their qualities such as the four fearlessnesses and 10 powers and so forth. And so these serve as the basis for establishing emptiness. And so it's mentioned that the perfection of wisdom teachings mention that all these are empty. Therefore, when commenting on these teachings of the perfection of wisdom, Master Nagarjuna, commenting on the explicit content, he wrote the six texts of reasoning and so forth were written by the other masters. So having the experience and having really tasted this teaching of emptiness, so that the fact that we are able to make, shake our negative emotions, causing fear to them, is thanks to Master Nagarjuna's teachings on emptiness. And then regarding the implicit content of the perfection of wisdom teachings, we have Abhisamaya Alamkara, by Mother Maitreya and so forth. Abhisamaya Alamkara and others, as well as masters like Asanga and his brother, who followed that tradition of the extensive conduct lineage. And we have the commentaries on the Abhisamaya Alamkara, known as the clear meaning commentary by Hari Bhadra. And so those who study Abhisamaya, pursue the study of perfection of wisdom and parchin, based on themselves on this commentary by Hari Bhadra. So we recite, therefore, the verses of salutation from Abhisamaya Alamkara, a verse of salutation from Abhisamaya Alamkara, and also Master Nagarjuna's salutation verses from Mula Madhyamaka Karika. This is what we are going to do.
Hangi denji nawa jung dawa mewa ken mewa chewa mewa dang mewa wongwa mewa dung mewa Taje teme denji me chewa nye shi shi denwa zowe sanye ma Tamba ten la cha ten lo
To you who is supreme speaker among all fully enlightened Buddhas, I am all teachers, I pay homage to you.
Ooh.
For hundreds of inconceivable hundreds of eons. So, whatever Dharma discourse we do, as I said earlier, the other day, it's important to turn the Dharma into a Dharma practice, make the Dharma Dharma. And particularly, in accordance with the perfection of wisdom teachings, we are doing this Dharma discourse. And therefore, we'll do the practice of taking refuge and also cultivate this spirit of enlightenment, bodhicitta, in order to bring benefit to all sentient beings who are as infinite as the expanse of space. All of us want happiness and not suffering. And then happiness should come by subduing our mind, disciplining our mind, and not from outside, but from within ourselves. And therefore, we should have a very good altruistic sense of altruism, and not just blindly following this kind of practice blindly, but by using our intelligence. So the verse that we are going to say says that it's is about taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, where we say, "I take refuge in the Buddha, to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I take refuge until I'm enlightened." And then the next two lines show the spirit of enlightenment, in which we say that through the practices of generosity and so forth, and accumulating merit and wisdom, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. And therefore, if you have a good understanding of how to go about with the practice of the teaching of the Buddha, just by reciting this verse, you'll have the idea as to how you should think. And so sometimes in this prayer, we say that may through the accumulation of merit, by giving and so forth, may I become an enlightened. So here we are only mentioning merit and not the other aspect of the practice, which is the wisdom. So with regard to the wisdom part, as unlike that of the altruistic path, we come across, with regard to that, we come across the term I in these lines. And so if you think through, of course, this I does exist. It's not that when we say there is no self, it doesn't mean that it's non-existent. We're not talking about nihilism. But we have a notion of an I, which is right here in the center of the body, solidly reciting. Whatever prayers and Radha Yoga practices and so forth we do, such as practices like accumulating wealth and so forth, we have this sense of I, a strong sense of I, as if it's somewhere here in the center of the body. And so, when we come across the word I in the prayer, we should always remind ourselves of the fact that this I, which appears to me, which is the appearance of it, does not exist. And so, I usually say this verse from Mula Madhyamaka Karika, Where it says that the Tathagata is neither the aggregates nor different from it, and the Tathagata is not in the aggregates nor the aggregates in it, and the Tathagata does not possess the aggregates. And so I switched the Tathagata to myself, saying, I am neither the aggregates nor the aggregates separate from it, and so forth. And in this way, it really helps me to gain an insight into the selflessness, emptiness. And so when you recite these lines, you should also be able to feel inspired to have this insight into emptiness while when you come across this I. And so, whatever practice of Dharma you do, it should be complemented or imbued with the sense of taking refuge and the spirit of enlightenment, coupled with that of the wisdom of emptiness. And so, just as we have the tradition, let's recite this verse to the Buddha, Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. I take refuge until I'm enlightened through the practice of, through the accumulation of merit and wisdom by giving and so forth. May I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. To the Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Assembly, I take refuge until I'm enlightened through the accumulation of merit and wisdom by giving and so forth. May I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. This is said three times. So all the gods and titans and so forth come forth to listen to this teaching of the Buddha, which is like a nectar to the ear, and it dispels all the suffering and the negative emotions from within our minds stream. So I'll teach in the languages of the humans and gods, asuras and so forth. So this text that I recited says that the teaching of the Buddha dispels all the suffering of the all the disease of negative emotions. And so whether we have happiness or not depends on whether we are able to discipline our mind or not. And so the text says the thing along this, the meaning of this teaching. So in the tradition of Kuno Lama Rinpoche, Tenzin Gyaltsen, who received many teachings, most of his teachings from masters in Kham, and so in his tradition, he said, praise from of the Buddha, a verse of praise to the Buddha. He would recite verses from different texts like Sutra, Mahayana Sutra, Alamkara, and so forth. Every day he would recite different texts, different verses. But I usually recite this one verse, which is homage to the Buddha, the Gautama, who, moved by his compassion, taught the sacred Dharma to rid us of negative emotions, distorted views. So how is the translation going on for you in the different languages? Chinese is okay.
Then Vietnamese, Korean.
Vietnamese and Korean.
Okay. English translation.
Is it coming through well? No. Russian.
Okay.
Just give a thumbs up if you are at least getting the signal well. And then Mongolians, are you able to hear well?
Spanish.
Spanish
translation.
French. Japanese.
Okay. Yeah.
So the other day, when we had taking care of the disciples ceremony. Of course, not everyone was here. Of course, Kala Chakra initiation is full of blessing. Of course, it's sacred. But the real practical means of making transformation within ourselves,
Mm-hmm.
I could make a distinction between these two categories of the teaching of the Buddha. One is the general structure, and the other is the specifically tailored teaching. According to Nyingun Tsongrapa, and so the structure, the Sutrayana, comes within the general structure of the teaching of the Buddha, whereas Master Nagarjuna's Dorje and Dose, and then the five stages and so forth, are the teachings pertaining to the specifically tailored teachings. And so the tantric teachings were taught according to the mental dispositions of the disciples, the individual disciples, as well as the constituent factors of their nerve systems, or the nadis and chakras and bindus and so forth. And regarding these, there is difference between Kala Chakra tradition system and then the Bhagwes Samaja and Heruka systems. And so accordingly, we have the different tantric teachings. And then we have the five Buddha families, according to which the disciples, during the procedure of giving the initiation in the mandala rite, and particularly the practice of completion stage, I mean, there are differences as well. And so these are specifically tailored for individuals. And it's sometimes the Buddha arose in the form of the main deity, who is a bhikshu, a monk, in the form of a monk. But in most cases, that's not the case. But the Buddha arose in the form of some deity, the chief deity of the mandala. So usually I'm frank, and I say that of course the Buddhism, I mean the tantric teaching, really spread widely in Tibet. But in order for an effective practice of the tantra, and we should be able to do that and practice and with based on and grounded in the general structure, Sutrayana practice, the bodhicitta and the wisdom of emptiness. So if you have a good understanding of or the wisdom of emptiness or the view of emptiness, whether it's according to the Madhyamaka or Chittamatra view, a philosophical view, then if you do tantric practice, it would be good. Otherwise, without any understanding of the view of emptiness, just doing some deity yoga will not mean much. So sometimes people say that, according to the Sutrayana, it takes three countless eons to get Buddhahood, to get to Buddhahood, and that's too tiring. And then they say that, according to the highest yoga tantra, you can become enlightened within a short period of time, such as one lifetime, and in one body, and then also others. So someone is telling the people, the organizers, to leave the media people where they are. They will just keep taking pictures and so forth. It doesn't matter. So they have freedom. So they, in any case, they need to take pictures. And so if they could get good shots, it would be better, wouldn't it? And so otherwise they would have to go to some corner and take picture and may not get good shots. So we have to really be pay attention, serious attention to the general structure of the teaching. As I have been saying this, and many of you may have heard, we need to be 21st century Buddhists. Why do I say this? Is because in the past we have rather been thinking that we are fortunate, and because the teaching of the Buddha spread the length and breadth of the land of Tibet snows, and we were taking it for granted. And therefore, we were not doing much analysis, investigation into the teaching. But today we are in the 21st century, and of course, educational standards is improving. And therefore, we are at a time when we need to really check the reality of things. And even with regard to the teaching of the Buddha, we need to scrutinize it, as the Buddha himself has actually permitted us to do so, when he said, "O monks and scholars, just as the gold is tested by cutting, rubbing, and burning, likewise you should examine my teaching and accept it, not because you have devotion or faith in me." And so, masters of Nalanda, like the Nagarjuna, and his followers, such as Chandrakirti, who in his Madhyamaka Avatara says that sutras such as these should not be taken literally, after doing scrutiny into the teaching of the Buddha, the masters like him have said that we cannot take such and such teachings literally, because it goes against reason. And so there's no other tradition in the whole of the world which actually says that the teaching of the founder himself must be put to the test of reasoning. And there is no other tradition within Buddhism itself, apart from the Nalanda tradition. And therefore, we need to study what the teaching of the Buddha is, what is the basis, the ground, the path, and the result, and so forth. As it is said, by understanding what the teaching of the Buddha is, may I gain certainty in the teacher, gain conviction in the teacher. And therefore, the teaching of the Buddha, you should be able to gain conviction. And on the basis of that conviction and understanding of the teaching of the Buddha, bear faith in the teaching of the Buddha. This is how we should go about with the teaching. Otherwise, having received the Kalachakra initiation, even if you may do tens of millions of the recitation of mantra and doing retreat, it may not be of much benefit. So I'm thinking of actually how to benefit you who have come to the teaching. And if you could also think of taking something that is beneficial for you, having come here, therefore I have decided to give the teaching on Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, the guide to the Bodhisattva way of life, and which focuses mainly on equaling and exchanging self and others with regard to the spirit of enlightenment, and then also with wisdom. It teaches the wisdom of emptiness. In this ninth chapter, the view of emptiness is taught rather briefly, but it's important for you to have a very broad understanding of the teaching of the Buddha. And therefore, the stages of meditation, the middle book, lays out basis of the teaching is, and then how to progress along the path and the grounds and the paths. And so it will help you to gain an understanding into the sequential nature of the practice of the Buddha's teaching. And therefore, I'm teaching by combining these two texts this time. I received the explanatory transmission of Bodhisattva Charya Avatara in this very place in Bodh Gaya from Kunlama Rinpoche Tenzin Gyaltsen from Kinnor, who received his teaching from his master in Kham. I don't remember the name of that teacher. And so I received the teaching on the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara from him. And then the regarding the stages of the path, I received the transmission or explanatory transmission from Sakya Abbot, Sangye Tenzin Rinpoche. And so it was also here, I think, in Bodh Gaya. And I was having a chat with him, a conversation with him, and in our conversation it came out that he had received the transmission of this text when he was going on a pilgrimage in Samye. And he reached Samye. When he reached there, he found out that a lama from Kham was teaching the Bhavana Krama, the stages of meditation, sitting on the throne from where Master Chandrakshita was said to have given teachings. So when he taught me that he received this transmission, the explanatory transmission, I really felt that it's indispensable for me to receive the teaching as well. And so when we talk about making transformation within our mind, it won't happen just by listening to a teaching once, but you need to really think through, reflect on the teaching over and over again for years, decades, and so forth. And therefore, if you can have the text with you, it would be helpful and beneficial. Therefore, I have asked the organizing committee of the Kala Chakra teaching to publish the book. And so how many of you have this book in Tibetan? He's always showing it in Tibetan. So most of the monks seems to have the book. And then the English... How many of you have it? Please raise the copy that you have. So he's almost can see. So it seems not many of the people have the text.
Oh, yeah.
So that I was just giving the reason why I wanted to give teaching on these texts. So sitting on this throne, I am here to introduce the teaching of the Buddha to you, and you are the audience of the teaching of the Buddha. Because I'm giving a Dharma teaching, a Dharma discourse, I'm sitting on the throne. Otherwise, we are all same human as human beings. We are all same. All the 7 billion people are same. We were born the same way, and we are going to die the same way. And therefore, while we are alive, we have the negative emotions such as desire or attachment, anger or hatred and ignorance. But we also have naturally have the potential for cultivating and developing love, compassion, bodhicitta. And so we all don't want suffering but want happiness. This was there even when we were in in the embryo stage. And so all living beings, all sentient beings, including animals, birds, insects, and so forth, want happiness and not suffering. In our text, there's mention of the trichilokism, and then the rabjam, and the hugely vast world systems, the first, second, third, and so forth. And so... looking from our own experience, we know that all sentient beings within the whole of these kind of different world systems are same in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. And so those who are gathered here also are same in wanting happiness and not suffering, and we are also same in having the negative emotions, attachment, anger, and so forth. And also, we as human beings have this intelligence. We are same in that respect as well. And therefore, when I teach, when I say something, it helps you. if you are somebody different from human beings, then when I share my experience and my knowledge, then if your basic mentality and the way of thinking and so forth are different, it may not be beneficial and helpful to you. For example, regarding Master Shandarakshita, he was someone who was combating combating his self-cherishing attitude and the grasping at true existence. And the teaching of the Buddha is such that, as it is said in this verse, we are not creating the causes for suffering, but creating the causes for developing the causes for happiness. So we are, it's not about the teaching of the Buddha, that's not about, because the teaching of the Buddha says so, but we want happiness, not suffering. And so the actions which give rise to suffering and happiness, I mean, whether you have happiness or not, I mean, or suffering, it depends on whether your mind is disciplined or not. And therefore, to discipline the mind, we have the teaching. And so, I mean, the teaching of the Buddha is different from other traditions in that respect. Of course, all traditions have the teaching, are meant for making transformation within. But on the one hand, there are those traditions which are based mainly on faith to make transformation, whereas in Buddhism, what he said is the negative, destructive emotions are the factors which cause us to lose a peace of mind, a disturbance in our mind. So how these negative emotions arise within us and what are its antidotes, how to apply the antidote to them is shown in the teaching of the Buddha. And so from this, it's different. And so all the 7 billion people are same in wanting happiness, not suffering. And from amongst these 7 billion, about 1 billion are non-believers. And then there are atheists who are negative towards the teachings, the religious traditions. And then there are, with regard to the believers in the religions, there are about 6 billion. Maybe. So on the whole, all of us are same in not wanting suffering, but wanting happiness. But the main cause of our happiness is love and compassion. And all of us, 7 billion people, were born from our mothers. And therefore, the love and compassion is something that is within ourselves by nature, biologically. So maybe some of you have not heard this. I have, for the last over 30 years, I've been having dialogues and discussions with scientists. And in some of the recent such meetings with scientists, some of the scientists have done some research, experiment with children, infants, maybe about 5-6 months old, to whom the scientists showed different pictures, movies, like animations. So I was also in the discussion on the panel. And so these children of 5-6 months old, pre-verbal children, babies, infants, so they have not much influence from outside yet. Maybe they see things, different things with their eyes, but they're basically not tainted by outside influence. And so the innate quality of the mind was still quite fresh, untainted, unblemished. And so when these scientists showed this animation to such children, such infant, So in the animation, the scientists showed two children playing and laughing with each other and helping each other, being kind to each other. And they, when the infant saw the animation, the infant also expressed joy. I saw that. When this infant was shown another animation where one child was actually in the animation, one child was pushing some ball uphill, trying to push a ball uphill. And so while trying to push it uphill, then another child comes and helps the first child to push the bull up. And then the infant child who saw that in animation felt happy and joyous. And then in the second animation, when the first child was pushing the ball uphill, another child comes from the front and pushes it down the hill. And that when that was shown to the infant child, the pre-verbal infant child, the infant child also had this negative expression on his face. Maybe he was thinking perhaps how bad that second child was, who was pushing it down. And so this shows that even an infant at that stage shows joy and happiness when some love and affection is shown, whereas when a negative thing is done, then the child does not feel joyous. And then some scientists also say that when you are constantly have fear and anger, or anxiety and anger and so forth, it actually weakens our immune system. And therefore, they say that when you are sustained by compassion, love, and affection, it actually helps the immune system to strengthen as well. And therefore, these scientists have said that the basic nature of human beings is compassionate. And therefore, I felt, if that is the case, then there is some hope for us. And so, just as in the external world, when we have a seed sown in the ground, we need to put water and manure and so forth for it to grow. Likewise, we need to nurture this seed of compassion within ourselves. So it's not just that we have power or wealth and so forth, or someone who could speak nicely to others, but if you actually show love and compassion to others, they would also love you back and they also will trust you. And therefore, that having that basic compassionate nature within ourselves as the seed, we should, through education and helping to use our intelligence, and we should be able to teach children, what is the benefit, advantage of developing compassion further. And if you if you are angry and so forth, what is the disadvantage of that? We are not talking about past or future lives or liberation and so forth. But in this very life, as human beings, we need to live together in our human community. So today, this is the reality. In the past, for example, in Vasubandhu's Abhidhamma Koshakarika, he mentions the six continents, which doesn't mention Europe or America or Africa and so forth, but and so the world at that time, people were living in separate communities independently of one another. But today, that's not the case. Whether it's economically or even environmentally, we are living as one human community. If something goes wrong in one continent, it affects the rest of the continents, the world, continents of the world. So that's the reality. And therefore, since this is the case, we need to have one, a sense of oneness of human beings today. In reality, our future happiness, a happy future, must be achieved by living together. Otherwise, if we live in divisions, divided and amongst others, that doesn't really fit the reality, today's reality as well. So it's not some kind of a poetry that we are talking about when we say all sentient beings. So of course, when we say, oh, may all sentient beings have happiness, of course the other world systems, we may not have much to do, that connection. And then even in this world, with regard to the sentient beings, we cannot do much for other sentient beings, like animals, birds, and so forth. And then most of the problems in this world are created by our human beings, Of course, we complain about mosquitoes, but mosquitoes, you cannot combat war against mosquitoes as such. But the troubles in the world today are caused by human beings because of using this human intelligence as a servant of, an effector for using our negative emotions to destroy others. So we make divisions, thinking them and us, and religion-wise, race-wise, and also economically, we make division between rich and poor and so forth. And God, then, because of that division that we create, we also kill each other. If we leave the things as it is today, and then we our prayer saying, may all sentient beings have happiness, is just a lip service, and it's actually a lie. If you remain indifferent to what's happening in the world, people are being killed in different parts of the world, and if you remain indifferent to that, you are lying. And therefore, if we could do something for people to gain more, pay more attention to take interest in the love and compassion, of course, we cannot do it. It would be good, not through some religious tradition, but through a secular means, by using scientific findings, as I already talked about, the findings of scientists, and having our love and compassion, having its positive effect on health. And if you live in a compassionate community, you as individual will be happy, and a family will be happy, and students and teachers will be also happy with each other. And so the teacher would be respected by his students, and because of the compassionate nature of the teacher. Otherwise, if the teacher is someone who abuses his children, the students also might try to find devious means how to deceive his teacher. And therefore, love and compassion is the root of our happiness. If a couple is loving and compassionate to one another, they will have the both will be happy. Otherwise, with lots of suspicion, jealousy, and so forth, they will not be happy at all. And therefore, love and compassion is the root of happiness. So when we say someone is our enemy, right from the beginning at birth, that person wasn't our enemy. But because the person did something that made you dislike them, therefore they become enemies or adversaries. And therefore, so you are also involved in their action that you disliked. And therefore, so you should make a distinction here. between regarding this love and compassion that we are talking about here, it is this unbiased love and compassion, which means a love and compassion which is not tinged by our attachment. Whereas when we have love towards our near and dear ones, like our relatives and so forth, we say, oh, that person is nice to me, kind to me, and therefore I like him. And there is this tinge of attachment towards the person. Whereas an enemy, of course, is causing you a problem, may dislike you, but generating compassion towards that enemy, thinking that that person also is the same like me in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. And so this is the kind of love and compassion that we are emphasizing, this unbiased. What is the advantage of this kind of, if you have this, what is the disadvantage if you don't have it? And if you could actually introduce these to the children right from the beginning, if we could give education on love and compassion like that in, say, school system, we could perhaps have children who grew up in this kind of environment, loving, compassionate environment, unlike us. So, of course, love and compassion, we have the seed for compassion within ourselves, but it's not nurtured as the children are given education. The existing education system itself does not have a place yet for that kind of education of love and compassion. And therefore, the education is more materialistically oriented one. And therefore, the children growing up in this kind of environment also have a materialistic way of life. And materialistic way of life, and they only think of material development, material gain, and so forth. So the material development, material advancements could help us to have sensory gratification, more or less sensory gratification, and that is what most people actually pay attention to, listening to some beautiful music or seeing some beautiful sights and having finding gratification from the alcohol and drugs and so forth, and then the touch, which includes sex. So these kind of experiences based on sensory perception are considered important, but they are very transitory. So if you watch a football match, people show lots of joy, but when the show is gone, when the tournament is over, that joy is gone. What we need to find is a stable joy and happiness without, so that you have a satisfaction not based on this kind of sensorial gratification, but using our own mind itself. And so all the religious traditions, the major religious traditions, so all of which teach faith, and faith has to do with our mind, not the sensory perceptions. The five sensory perceptions. So if you could draw satisfaction using your own mind without relying on the sensory perceptions, whether you are rich or poor, educated or uneducated, you'll have a real satisfaction and happiness. Based on such developing our happiness based on this kind of practice is very important, and therefore we need training of mind. For that, we need to understand the workings of mind, the system of emotions and system of mind. And for that, we have the ancient Indian traditions, which have the practice of single-pointed concentration and insight meditation, and therefore we have the explanation, extensive explanation of the mind system of emotions, mind in the ancient Indians system of thought. So, of course, within the religious traditions, among the religious traditions, there are those which are mainly based on faith alone to reach their goal, whereas others, such as Buddhism and other traditions in Indian thought, do not emphasize faith alone, but using our intelligence. Whether you are a believer or not, in short, we all do not want suffering, but want happiness. And suffering comes, suffering ensues from our undisciplined mind, this unruly mind. And to tame our mind, the important practice is that of love and compassion. And so this is what we need for all human beings, whether believers or non-believers. And therefore, as a human being, I always feel that I am one of. I always feel that I am one of them. We are same human in the sense of me being human beings. Whether I meet with some leaders or others, I always feel. And so, when the other person acts like someone special, like a leader and so forth, then I feel bored sometimes, and then I would say, "Oh, I'm in a hurry." So it's very important for us to bear this oneness of humanity. I always say that if I emphasize that I am I'm a Buddhist, I'm Tibetan, and I'm His Holiness the Dalai Lama, especially His Holiness the Dalai Lama, there's only one Dalai Lama in the whole world, and I would remain just isolated, alone. But because I feel I'm one of the humanity, I am same like other human beings, I have lots of friends around me. Otherwise, if I feel myself to be somebody special as His Holiness the Dalai Lama, then I would remained alone and I will feel lonely without any friends. And so, I'm very happy to think that I'm same like the other person that I meet, such as this President of America. And so with that kind of attitude, you feel close to the other person easily. So if otherwise the other person, for example, the President of America might, if they feel that and consider that being the president and to be more important than just being a human being, I don't feel good about that. And so, so for your own goodness, for your own good and happiness, it's important to feel that the others, you are like other sentient, other human beings. So whenever I meet others, I laugh or smile. I don't need any introduction of the other person. The other person has two eyes, one nose, one mouth, and two ears. And so, there's no need for introduction. Just meeting that person with a human face is enough. And therefore, I smile, and I actually try to be frank with the person. So when you laugh or smile at others, then the other person also responds positively like that. Otherwise, if you remain stern, there's not going to be any positive response from others. I asked school children, which one do you prefer, someone with serious face or someone who smiles? And all the children say, I'm a smiling face. So some people are quite serious. Even if you try to smile at them, laugh with them, they don't smile back. And therefore, when they remain so serious, I tickle them so that they are forced to laugh. So if you consider others to be same like yourself as a human being, oneness of sense of oneness of human beings, I mean, you will have respect from others. You also respect them. So they like them. They like you. You like them. So this is really I'm great. I mean, I really profit from this. So some of you who feel that you are some abbot or this or that, you will remain alone, a lonely person, and that's a disadvantage on your part.
Oh yeah.
So this is talking on the level of being human being. There are people from different countries. So we are all friends, human beings. So there may be a few tens of thousands. So you can tell others that having come here, you can tell others that, I mean, the Dalai Lama says that it's important to have the sense of oneness of human beings, and as it is said in the Bodhisattva Acharya Avatara itself, that you should always have this countenance, when smiley face. So remain smiley. Whichever country you have come from, be happy and have smiles on your face. And then, first, if you smile at others, then others will also respond with a smile. You are giving them an opportunity to do so. So one time I was in Germany. I was asked to come somewhere, and therefore towards the evening. So when I was passing in the street to go to that place, a young lady was coming from the other direction, opposite direction, and I smiled and went at the lady looking from my window, and she actually had maybe some kind of a suspicion, and she actually gave me a very bad look. And so I also turned my face around. So you can do the same with the others. Smile first, and if they don't respond positively to you with a smile, then you can turn your face around. And then secondly, as a Buddhist monk, even in dream, I always feel that I am a monk. So from my own experience, I know that the practice of the teaching has helped me. And therefore, I also feel that people who follow their religious traditions sincerely and could really benefit from their own tradition. So, for example, in the Christianity, of course, philosophically, we have different philosophical ideas. But if you look at the Christian practitioners like Mother Teresa, how much did she help poor and need destitute people? And so I have many friends within the Christians and Jews, Muslims, who really are dedicated to the well-being, for the well-being of others, welfare of other people. So all religious traditions have the same message of love. And also similarly, tolerance, contentment, and self-discipline. So from religious point of view, all these major religious traditions are same from the religious perspective, in terms of the religious practice. But philosophically, of course, there are differences. We have the theistic and non-theistic religions. Within the non-theistic, there are those who assert self or Atman, and then those who deny Atman or soul theory. And within Buddhism, there are some sub-schools within Buddhism who assert some kind of an inexpressible self. So, from the point of view of taking refuge in the three jewels, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, they are Buddhists, but philosophically speaking, they are considered non-Buddhist from the philosophical point of view. And therefore, we have different philosophical systems. Within Buddhism itself, there are different philosophical thoughts and systems. So there are big differences philosophically amongst these religious traditions of the world. But all of these traditions, I mean, which have the philosophical difference, are meant for the same purpose. The goal is to promote love and compassion. No one says that God, those who assert or accept Creator God, do not say that God is full of anger, but that God is full of love, infinite love, and so forth. And therefore, to the extent you have this faith in your God being an infinite love, I mean, and you have respect for that, I mean, therefore you will also respect others, creatures as well. And these different philosophical traditions are needed because of the different mental dispositions of the different beings. And for that reason, the Buddha himself, seeing that there are different mental dispositions amongst his followers and disciples, taught different philosophical systems. And so, the religious traditions spread in India, for example, and then Arab region, and in which the Middle East, and then these different religions like Judaism, Islam, and Christianity spread in the Middle East. And geographically, we have different places, and the lifestyles of people are different, and therefore people's habits and customs are also, I mean, there will be differences. So within India, I mean, you have southern Indians, I mean, with different mental dispositions. And therefore, in accordance with the mental dispositions of the different people, I mean, we need different philosophical thoughts and systems for the promotion of love and compassion. I am a Buddhist monk, and not only that, I have also studied Brahmana Vartika, Tatu Samgraha by Shanda Rakshita, and so, although I have not studied them in great detail, but I have studied them. And so, I feel, although I follow the Buddhism, but I also pay respect to all the different religious traditions of the world, because all these religions are beneficial to the human beings, whoever are following them. And therefore, one time when I was in Australia, I had a Christian friend, a Christian minister who was actually helping people, homeless people, feeding them and giving them place to stay and so forth, lunch, soup kitchen. And so, at a talk that he organized, he introduced me, and in his introduction, he said, the Dalai Lama is a good Christian. And then, in my speech, I said that he was a good Buddhist. And then, in South India, when I met a Hindu Swamiji, in our discussion, I said that we have the same practice of the three trainings, three shiksha. the training of morality, concentration, and wisdom. But the difference between your tradition and my tradition is that you assert an independent self or Atman, whereas me, as a Buddhist, do not assert that. And so, the theory of Atman is very beneficial to you, and therefore you should go with it. And the selflessness theory is beneficial to me, and this is our individual business. And but despite that, we have this difference, we have the same practice of the three trainings: training of morality, concentration, and wisdom. And therefore, I always feel if all the religious tradition could live harmoniously with one another. And today, when we are at a time when people are killing each other, one another, in the name of religion, if we could actually have people of different religions come together and learn from one another, it's very important to create a harmony amongst all the religious traditions. And so, those of you who have gathered here, please bear this in mind. And then, thirdly, I am, as a Tibetan, since the fifth Dalai Lama, the Dalai Lamas have been the dual responsibility, temporal and spiritual authority. But since 2011, I resigned from the political authority, political responsibility, and I am called focus myself more on the spiritual matter. So since 2001, Tibetans had politically elected leadership, and then I became semi-retired from political matters and responsibility, and from 2011, I became fully retired from the political. So I emphasize, I focus more on the Tibetan, with regard to the Tibetan matter, I focus more on the Tibetan environment and Tibetan spiritual tradition. So we have the different fields of learning, such as learning Sanskrit, medicine, arts and crafts, and then logic, and then the inner science. So we have texts on these subjects in our own language since the time of Master Chandrakshita, who actually advised Tibetans to have the translations of the teachings in our language. And today, with regard to these, we could actually consider what we have, this cultural tradition that we have, as not just Tibetan treasure, but the treasure of the world. And therefore, we have this treasure with which we could actually contribute to the world, and particularly in terms of the science of mind and science logic. Epistemology. These are even taken interest in by the scientists as well. And so, therefore, we could make some contribution from our own traditional cultural heritage to the whole world. Our ancestors really worked hard to have these different subjects in our own language. The translators translated them. And therefore, today, in terms of explaining the teaching of the Buddha through logic and also the study of logic regarding these and the Tibetan language is the best. So in other fields of learning, like modern subjects, modern science and so forth, of course, we have not used our language, and therefore, maybe we are lagging behind. But with regard to Buddhist tradition of Buddhism, the teaching of the Buddha and science of mind, emotions, and logic, Tibetan language is the best. So not only does this language and the tradition that we have could help us, Tibetans, but the rest of the world could benefit from it. And so preserving Tibetan culture, Tibetan religion and spirituality is not about building monasteries, temples and so forth, but by learning them, we make ourselves educated in our tradition and be practical about them. So having the monasteries, temples and also the statues in the monasteries will not help that in that.
And I consider that my own responsibility to preserve the Tibetan language and script until I die, and especially for the Tibetan people here, so you have to really work hard. And even for the monks who are really studying with these philosophical studies, you should not take it for granted. And you have to study different fields, including science and so on, so that you can combinedly study the Buddhist philosophy and the studies. In Tibet, we have not been able to have any contact with the outside countries for many years, and our mindset has been very narrow for many years. And even for myself, and I think in 1956, I came to China and also to India. And in 1954 and 1955, I went to Beijing and many other cities in China. At that time, the relations and the connections were not very extensive. And I came to India in 1956. And when I came again in 1959, still we were not really very much realized about the connections. Then gradually, when we tend to understand more about the world in general and so on, and when we arrived at the very vast foundations and the platform of the international platform, then how can we contribute to the international platform, and how what we can take from the international level? So that's really helpful. It also really helpful to me as a, to me personally, and also very helpful. I can when I share my experiences with other people. And please, my friends of Tibet, please keep this in mind. And till now, you have been really very supportive, especially my Chinese friends here. Through the history, we have a huge relation for many centuries. And all over the world, wherever there are Chinese people, there are Chinese temples, Buddhist temples to be seen. And even today, the largest number of Buddhist followers, those studying Buddhists, were actually Chinese, is about 400 million people studying Buddhist in China. And for the Tibetans also, we have to also study, and we have to treasure the gem that we have, and also we have to work towards polishing it so that it becomes accordingly to the international level. So as the tea arrived, so that part, have you got tea? So we do the tea offering. As we have discussed before, the very nature of the human being is compassionate. Since the very basic nature of per human is compassionate, so the teachings of any religions can be practiced only in the human society, so it cannot be practiced in animal society or animal realm. So therefore, it is something that has to be only studied and practiced in human society. And since the nature of the basic human is compassionate, so most of the religions present the compassionate basis, guidance and the teachings. So this is very important, and what I see that all religions and the traditions must work towards presenting to how to progress and how to enhance and how to make one another person more compassionate. And when we speak about the teachings coming from religion, and if you enter having creating more divisions between one and the other, then it's not benefit. And nowadays we even have communalism, even resorting to killings between different communities, which are really not according to the teachings of any religion. And even for the Buddhist, we have to really be very pay our reverence and respect to all the other religions. Of course, there are some exceptions, since we are millions and billions of the people. There will be some instances. In India is a huge country, so there will be some exceptions who create some troubles. But in general, this is a really a great country where every religion and faith traditions live in harmony. If you so in India there are very less compared to divisions between different faith and traditions. And as I used to say that in India, for over thousands of years, there is a tradition of all the faith traditions, the followers living in harmony and in a very peaceful manner. And we have to work hard as I think the Indian I used to urge the Indian government and also my Indian Dharma friends to work towards the religious harmony, not only in India but also to the international level. And so today our context, our teaching is about Buddhist teaching, and the Pali traditions, the teachings coming from Pali tradition is the foundation. And we used to say the Mahayana or Hinayana, and some even say Vajrayana. So Tantrayana. So these are due to the not having enough understanding about the teachings. So if you disregard anyone saying that they belong to the Hinayana practitioners and so on, then it is our misunderstanding. So they have huge realizations and practices based especially to Vinaya and the selflessness and so on. Of course, there are some differences when it comes to to the philosophies. But fundamentally, they're all the same. And for, on the other side, those of us who claim to be Mahayana, but still even just merely claiming as being Mahayana, but in practical, most of us were not able to, our practices were not in accordance to Mahayana teachings. So claiming oneself as the Mahayana, and if you disregard and do not pay respect to the Hinayanas, so this is very poor. And it's the same case to the Bali traditions, the followers of the Bali traditions. And if you if they consider the Mahayana practitioners a bit far from them, then this is also a big mistake. And I've been able to meet some of the Vinaya practitioners from Thailand, and I used to meet them more, and I used to tell them that if you study the Sanskrit texts and the commentaries, it will be very beneficial for you. The reason why I say is that in about 3 years ago, I met some scholars from Thailand, and we discussed about the Four Noble Truths and the 16 Aspects and the 37 Factors of Enlightenment and so on. And I asked them at that time, when you speak about the Four Noble Truths and when you do explanations, whether you rely upon merely to the scriptures or you have the reasonings. And they say that they rely only on the scriptures and there is no reasoning-based explanations. And if you look at the second chapter of the Brahmana Vardhika, the presentation of the Four Noble Truths has been grounded entirely on the reasoning. So therefore, I told and I urged them that if you are able to study those commentaries and the texts from the Sanskrit traditions, it will be very beneficial. To summarize, the Sanskrit traditions, it seems they are more towards the base on the reasoning. And as I said before, that you have to actually investigate based on the reasoning. And if it is the Buddha's own words, but if it is against the reasoning, then you have to abolish it. So this is amazing teaching. So since we have to go through the reasoning and investigation, so therefore the teachings of the Buddha are in accordance with the scientific, modern scientific investigations and the research. And on the other hand, when we speak about Tantrayana or the Vajrayana teachings, externally, as the Pali tradition speaks about the Vinaya practices and the commitments, and this has to be the base. And externally, Vinaya, and internally, the practice of the Bodhicitta, and secretly practicing the Vajrayana. So these three practices has to be combined together. And the teaching of the Buddha, which is prevalent in Tibet as of now, is really a very pure form of teaching that is preserved in Tibet. And if you consider it's without having sources, then it's a big mistake. So the Vinaya practices and commitments as coming from the Bali tradition has to be the foundation of our practice. Then we have to add upon it to the teachings on the emptiness and the selflessness coming from the profession of Wisdom Sutra. Then when it comes to the Deity Yoga practices and which are coming from the Tantrayana, then we have to add those practices to the base of the Vinaya practices. So finally we say externally Vinaya and internally Bodhicitta and secretly the Vajrayana practices. So if you have the very strong foundation of the Vinaya commitments and the practices, then you can build upon it the other practices. So therefore the foundation is very important.
So first,
we will start with the Acharya Kamalashila's, the middle volume of the Stages of Meditation. In the 8th century, by the Tibetan Emperor Tisong Dezen, Though the Buddhism came to Tibet even from the Emperor Songtsen Gampo, as he married, invited his wife from China and Nepal, as we have the Zhou statue in Lhasa. So there is already a connection and relation in the 7th century. So there is an interest already there even before that. But inviting the scholars from Nalanda University and considering the Nalanda as the most authentic sources, it was the Chandrakshita. Sorry, it was the Tizong Dezen Emperor who invited Chandrakshita. And we speak about sometimes the Chandrakshita stay for 600 years or so on. But some of my Indian friends say that when he came to Tibet, he was about 75 years or something. And one of my Indian friends also told me that, Chandrakshita actually lived for 90 years, not 900. So Tibetan people usually consider the longevity as, so therefore they add 10 to the 90 and make it 900. So whatever the case, so we have to solve the dispute, and the best is, if you look at the beard of the Chandrakshita, it's still there in the Samye Monastery. So maybe it was destroyed partly during the liberation. And even we can find today, as it is hidden. And in future, if you can, if we can do some scientific research and do some research, check, investigating the bone of Chandrakshita, then we can see how long he stayed, how many years he lived for. So to summarize, so he was, Chandrakshita was invited by Emperor Tizong Dezen, though he was quite old at that time, and even though he was at that time quite elder, but he readily accepted the invitation, and due to having a very strong relationship with the Tibetan people, he also came to Tibet. Then, in order to clear the obstacles, he was Padmasambhava was also invited to Tibet, and Padmasambhava acted as the main the person to dispel the obscurations for the flourishment of Buddhism in Tibet. And the King Emperor Tizong Dezen was the patron. So together, these three the great beings have been great service to the preservation and flourishment of Buddhism in Tibet. So in Samye Monastery, there is different sections, different departments, where there is a special department for concentration, where there people spend only for meditations. Then there is special for the tantra department. And in India, we can find the hermits or those who stay under the tree and practices. But in Tibet, we do not find. Tibet, normally, we have the two departments or the two divisions, which is the monastic community, the practitioners on the one side, and the lay practitioners on the other side. And in Samye Monastery, we can also find another department, which is the translation department. And I think that even during the Chandrakshita's time, there are meditators from China, the Chinese scholar. And at that time, these Chinese scholars say that for practice, the mere complete meditation is necessary, but we are not, that you cannot analyze or investigate the matter. So this kind of the concept of meditation was prevalent at that time in Tibet, and they consider it as the authentic meditation. And in Japan, I also heard by some scholars and some also non-scholars that merely meditating without doing an analytical investigations can attain enlightenment. And I told them that this is not true and this cannot be achieved. So the three wisdoms as we speak, first we need to listen to the teachings by reading, and then it has to be followed by the reflections or concentrations, then these two wisdoms has to be backed by the meditation at the third level. And there are some who only meditate by thinking about the heavens and the paradise. And there's another sections of meditators who merely stay in focus meditations. So these practices are still we can find. So in that concentration department at that time, so they tend to spread the idea that in order to attain enlightenment, you do not need to do very analytic investigations, but merely by meditating is enough. So in order to dispel such ignorance and to prevail the actual practice, his student Kamala Shila was invited to Tibet. So Acharya Kamala Shila also came to Samyang Monastery, and he gave teachings and did a lot of debate. And at that time, those debates were actually put into writing. And this writing now we have for the stages of meditation, the middling, and the great and the first. So the first part of the stages of meditation is mainly focused to the shamatha meditations, the calm abidance, and the third one is more focused towards the special insight. So first, since there is a huge number of the gatherings here, and the text has been printed and distributed to all, so I thought that it's important to give a complete transmission. So the important part I will explain a bit, but I wanted to make sure that you receive the lineage of the transmissions completely. And later, when you can also claim that you have received the complete transmissions of these two texts, having went to Bodh Gaya, but you have to continue to meditate. So first, the middle volume of the stages of meditation. In Sanskrit, is the Bhavana Akrama. In Tibetan, Gombe Rimba. Homage to the youthful Manjushri. I shall briefly explain the stages of meditation for those who follow the system of Mahayana Sutras. The intelligent who wish to actualize omniscience extremely quickly should make a deliberate effort. So if you look at the heading of the name of the text, which is the stages of meditation. So by meditation, we have two kinds of meditation, analytical meditation and the focus meditation. And to speak from my own experience, if you need to bring a change or transformation to yourself, you need to engage in the analytical meditations. Of course, the focus meditation is helpful, but that may not be so effective compared to analytical meditation, especially when it comes to meditating the practice of the exchange, equalizing and exchanging of self and other. So this kind of practices cannot be brought upon by mere faith. This has to be grounded in the reasons and investigations and the understanding generated out of it. And especially when it comes to the understanding of the wisdom of emptiness, we have to study a lot of the factors that is in front of us, and that the appearance of these things men are not in accordance to its actuality. So having trained in this way for a long time, then generally we will be able to reach a stage to appear the everything as an illusory. So this is a process that arrives in a gradual process. Therefore, the Tibetan term gom, which in English has the connotation of familiarization, is all about. The intelligent who wish to actualize omniscience extremely quickly should make a deliberate effort to fulfill his cause and condition. His Holiness comments that for most of the Indian texts, at the outset, we will find a presentation, a special presentation about the purpose of the text. and the purpose of the text and the purpose of the purpose and the connection and so on. So this is very important, especially to the intelligent students. And this may not be so effective for the lesser intelligence, but for the intelligent persons, first, when as soon as they see the text and they start reading, they can understand about the purpose of this text. And they see, if they study, engage in the studies of this text, there is a goal. And so that this may help them to make them study, engage in the studies of that text. So therefore, as we also have the same set of presentation by Hari Bhadra in the clear words, clear commentaries to the Prajnaparamita text. Similarly, we have the similar presentations here. And the text continues to read, it is not possible for omniscience to be produced without causes because if it were, everything could always be omniscient. If things were produced without a reliance on something else, they could exist without constraint. There will be no reason why everything could not be omniscient. So His Holiness comments that this really tells us about the very nature of all the phenomena. And the nature of the phenomena, for example, when we speak about the pleasant or the unpleasant feeling, so it is by nature, by changing. And if something is by nature, by mode of changing, then they have to rely on a cause or conditions for that changes to happen. And whatever the pleasant feeling or the unpleasant feeling that we get is actually due to causes that happen within us. So therefore, for a pleasant feeling to arise, we have to look for what are the causes that brings the pleasant feeling in us. So therefore, we have to walk towards the causes of this, causes which brings the happiness and the suffering to us, and walk towards minimizing the causes of suffering and increase the causes of happiness. And I've also seen the commentary of commentary on the Pramana by Kamala Shila, where he says that when you understand the interdependence of the cause and effect, you will be able to attain the liberation. And when you understand the interdependence of the selflessness or the next level, then one will be able to attain the omniscient. So therefore, merely not able to find the reality of the phenomena may not be the ultimate understanding or ultimate finding. As the Nagarjuna also says that when you engage in the search for the person, that the person may not be the earth element, the water, fire, and so on. But then the self is actually a composition of all these elements together. And also the Chandrakriti also expresses in the supplement of to the middle way that having refuted the existence of a strong self by the seven aspects of reasoning, so therefore, this tells us that the self or any phenomena do not have an intrinsic existence, but they do have an existence which is by naturally dependent origination. But then when it comes to the phenomena, usually they are those kind of phenomena which comes by a cause and which are the compounded phenomena. Those compounded phenomena, of course, they have a cause which brings about this phenomena. But the uncompounded phenomena such as space, though they do not have a cause, but they still rely upon different cause and conditions for them to happen. So, in this way, having understand the dependent origination based on cause and effect at the first level, secondly, we have to work towards generating the understanding of dependent origination based on mere designations. And also, as we say that the existence of a phenomena that is purely designated on one side, and there is not another valid cognition that goes against what we have found already. So in such a way, we will be able to find a reality. Something, if at the end of our practice, if there is something that you can still hold on to, then there is still something left, an intrinsic understanding, intrinsic perspective is still left. So therefore, we should be able to completely defeat that sense. For myself, it has been about 60 years since I started studying about emptiness, and it has been about 40 years since I really vigorously studied about the emptiness. And about 10 years back, when I really contemplate about the very nature of the phenomena and emptiness, and it really helps me to decrease the attachment and those kind of the conceptual thoughts that actually give rise to the attachment and the anger and so on. And as the Nagarjuna says that by the karma and the conceptual thoughts, these two actually brings about the attachment and the anger. And the attachment and the anger in turn bring the unhappiness. So the first, we have to look at the causes of the attachment and anger, which is the karma and the conceptual thought, the mistaken conceptual thought. So this is very important for us to understand the causes of the attachment. I also have a friend who is a scientist, and he's not a religious person. He's purely a scientist. We've been a friend for many years. I think about 3-4 years back, I went to see him at his personal residence. He was about 97 years old at that time. And he told me at that time that he used to do research about the person who are under stress due to very strong anger and so on, and try to bring a solution or remedies to those such kind of persons. And he told me that when he summarized all his findings, that when someone is in a high state of anger, in a high state of distress, so that other person, which appears very ugly or very humble to you, so that negative side, 90%, is a mental projection, but not a reality. And this, what he's finding, is actually very similar to what the Nagarjuna presents in the fundamental texts. And of course, I do not practice the practice of the calm abidance and the spiritual insight. But since I practice and meditate on the selflessness for a long time, so gradually I'm able to control those mistaken conceptual thoughts which give rise to the attachment and anger. So therefore, the view of emptiness is really very powerful. And today, so we will also read from the following verses and the text, the view of emptiness on the one side, and which is another is the bodhicitta, the awakening mind, which is the main content of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life by Shantideva. And these two, so you all have to make a strong resolution here that having received the Kala Chakra, you will practice it. So maybe after attending the Kala Chakra, you may not really understand about the initiations, but I will work hard towards the practice as much as possible, the awakening mind, and the view of emptiness. And at least when I recite the refuge-taking precepts, the verses, I will think about these values. And I will try my... if you merely think that those few days of my attendance to the teachings have been wonderful, but if it remains only at that level, that is not so much benefit. So all these mistaken conceptual thoughts also arises by cause and conditions. So therefore, since everything has to come from the cause and conditions, even the omniscience has to be also arise by cause and conditions. And Lord Buddha says that Lord Buddha cannot wash away the sins of the other people, nor can he transform or his own transfer his own understanding and realizations to others. So if he cannot even give you the his own realization as a present, so if that is the case, then Lord Buddha has meditated for, worked hard for three countless years and become enlightened. So how does Lord Buddha benefit the sentient beings? So it is through leading the disciples by presenting the reality of all the phenomena. And when we those teachings at the first level about the dependent origination of cause and effect, and at the next level, the dependent origination based on mere designation. So continue reading to the text. Therefore, since all functional things arise only occasionally, they depend strictly on their causes. Omniscience too is rare because it does not occur at all times and in places, and everything cannot become omniscient. Therefore, it definitely depends on causes and conditions. Training the mind. Also from among these causes and conditions, you should cultivate correct and complete causes. If you put the wrong causes into practice, even if you work hard for a long time, the desired goal cannot be achieved. It will be like milking a horn. Likewise, the result will not be produced when all the causes are not put into effect. For example, if the seed or any other causes is missing, then the result, a sprout, and so forth, will not be produced. Therefore, those who desire a particular result should cultivate its complete and unmistaken causes and conditions. If you asked what are the causes and conditions of the final fruit of omniscience, I, who am like a blind man, may not be in a position to explain, but I shall employ the Buddha's own verse just as he spoke them to his disciples after his enlightenment. His Holiness comments that the state of Buddhahood is actually granted or based, has to be given rise by, first by the practice of the great compassion. And when we speak about the great compassion, so the great compassion is about a very strong will to liberate every suffering sentient beings from their suffering. And this great compassion, in turn, will give rise to the generation of the bodhicitta, the awakening mind, which is of two intentional. So ultimately, the state of Buddhahood is again deeply rooted to the practice of great compassion. And I think it is in one of the texts of the Haribhadra that when he explains the bodhicitta, which is the awakening mind, that by wisdom one is able to focus towards the enlightenment, and by compassion one is able to focus towards the suffering. So this is one way of explanation coming from one of the texts of the Acharya Haribhadra. So therefore, from the six perfections, which are actually here considered as the skillful means, and from that, the wisdom has to be the ultimate. And another journal also says that for those who want to attain enlightenment, the first, the great compassion, is the most important. Then that has to be also given rise by the understanding of the emptiness, the non-dualism. And ultimately, the bodhicitta. And for that, so this order that is coming from one of the texts of Nagarjuna, the precious garland, the great compassion as the basis, and after that, the wisdom realizing emptiness and the bodhicitta. And so therefore, in order to understand the state of enlightenment, first we need to understand what is the state of enlightenment. So this can be possible only when you understand, when you have the wisdom realizing emptiness. So things, when things appear to you, the things around you, so when you look at those things, at that time, the true existence, the mind, the grasping of the true existence comes. And when things, when you reach the understanding that things do not have their own existence, then you get very near to the understanding of the no-selfness, no-self. And I don't know whether we can discuss about the emptiness with the scientists, but when we explain about the Tibetan arising, so the scientists also show very keen interest to know about that. And in the 400 verses, Aryadeva stated that, so if for someone to introduce Buddhism to someone, so the wisdom realizing emptiness is very important. In the Prajnaparamita text also, we have when we speak about the 10 the paths and the practices, the 10 instructions, so the 10 instructions have been usually, the verse also has that, first the instruction about the two truths, then the instruction about the four noble truths, and the refuge, and so on. So the first, which instruction is about the instruction on the two truths. And the next is the instruction on the Four Noble Truths, then to the instruction to the Three Jewels. So the teaching on the two truths comes first. So when by the teaching on the two truths, one will be able to understand the emptiness. So, and also based on the dependent origination of the cause and effect. With that, we will be able to move to the next level, which is the Four Noble Truths. And within the Four Noble Truths, when it comes to the true cessations, again, this has to be grounded to the wisdom realizing emptiness. And this can be also made possible only when we understand what are the sources of the suffering and that the afflicted emotions and the karma actually act as the main causes that give rise to suffering. And when you get the inspirations or the kind of the potentiality that these kind of afflicted emotions can be completely eliminated, then we get much nearer to the possibility of the attainment of the truth of cessations, which is the third noble truth. So then, if one is able to get such an understanding, then we will be quite near and we'll get an understanding that this is really a state which is free from all sufferings and afflicted emotions. So if you do not have any understanding about emptiness, we won't have really any grounded, any solid understanding about the Four Noble Truths. Also, we have to also take those teachings in the Uttara Tantra by the Maitreya about presenting the teachings about the very Buddha nature and so on. And with all these teachings combined together, we will be able to generate an understanding that the truth of cessation is something possible, something that we can attain. So then comes the fourth noble truth, which is the truth of the path. that through following the guidance of the Lord Buddha, we will be able to attain the cessations. And someone who has already attained the path is considered as the Sangha. So this order of the first presentation of the two truths at the first, which is followed by the presentation of the Four Noble Truths, is really wonderful. So through that, we can, the third instruction, which is the instruction about the three jewels, and with those two instructions first, as preceded, we will be able to generate a very complete understanding about the three jewels. So then when it comes to the third instruction about the refuge taking, we have to rely upon the three sets of sufferings. So with these three sets of sufferings, in order to dispel the strong attachment towards this life and also the strong attachment towards the next life and so on, we have to present the suffering upon suffering, suffering subject to change and the pervasive conditioning suffering. So these teachings also have to follow in order. Then this is to follow by the seven, as we usually discuss about the seven, 37 factors of enlightenment, about the perseverance, which is again followed by the clairvoyance and so on. And ultimately we will reach the path of meditation. And as we discussed yesterday about when usually we recite the Heart Sutra, we recite this mantra of Gade Gade, Para Gade, Para Sangade. And the first one actually presents, speaks about the path of accumulations. So the intelligent students, when they first understand the liberation state, they will understand that when they attained that set of the emptiness, they will reach the path of accumulations. And again, when that understanding of emptiness improves further, and when they are able to generate the spiritual insight towards the understanding of the wisdom, they reach the second path, which is the path of preparation. And when they directly witness or understand the emptiness, they reach the third path, which is the path of seeing. And the next 10 grounds, the spiritual grounds, as the understanding of the wisdom of emptiness improves further. So these are all in the path of meditations and ultimately attain the omniscient mind. And so we have to contemplate about this every day. And if you are, so the real thing that we have to eliminate is the true existence of the grasping that is present within us. There are no other obscurations externally. So the view of emptiness we will discuss in the following pages. So compassion, moved by compassion, Bodhisattva take the vow to liberate all sentient beings. Having entered into this practice, they will certainly complete the collection of merit and insight. Accomplishing the accumulation of merit and insight is like having omniscience itself in the palm of your hand. Therefore, since compassion is the only root of omniscience, you should become familiar with this practice from the very beginning. The compendium of perfect Dharma reads, O Buddha, a bodhisattva should not train in many practices. If a bodhisattva properly holds to one Dharma and learns it perfectly, he has all the Buddha's qualities in the palm of his hand. And if you ask what that one Dharma is, it is great compassion. The Buddhas have already achieved all their own objectives, but remain in the cycle of existence for as long as they are sentient beings. This is because they possess great compassion. They also do not enter the immensely blissful abode of nirvana like the hearers. Considering the interests of sentient beings first, they abandon the peaceful abode of nirvana as if it were a burning iron house. Therefore, great compassion alone is the unavoidable cause of the non-abiding nirvana of the Buddha.
And
So next is about to identify whether there is a beginning to the samsara and also to the self. And if we speak from the tantra point of view, all the body, speech and mind, we have three subtleties, the coarse, the subtle, and the subtlest one. And if we speak about this lifetime, it is the coarse. At the time of intermediate state of rebirth, it's the subtler. And at the time of the dying, the last moment of dying, it is the subtlest form of the clear light. So that the subtlest mind and its the energy, its energy. So these are the subtlest one. And I also did discussion with the scientists. So I discussed with my friend scientist that a mother whose womb is in perfect condition, and it's at the time of the menstruation, and the sperm of the father is also uncontaminated without any defects. So if these all qualities are met, if they all assemble, it is really necessary to conceive, and they say that it's not definite. So therefore, we need to rely upon another cause. So that another course is whether the intermediate state of rebirth is nearby or not. And the existence, the present existence of the previous life or the next life, even we can find in the non-Buddhist texts, the non-Buddhist community, that many children or infant, they remember their previous life. And also many villagers in India, they are very young children I met whom they remember their previous life, the incidents they recall very clearly. Since the person is actually identified by the continuum of the main consciousness. So, for example, the sensory, the five senses, of course, there are many conditions, but they're mere preceding the mind that really become the continuity, the previous continuity of all the mind. So when we say that the mind is actually a term that is given to a continuity of the different, a lot of moments together. So if you search in this way to the continually, it is very difficult to find. And when we speak about the three times, it is difficult to find the present time. So when we subject them to critical analysis, it is even difficult to find the present time. So the person, which is again designated about the mind or the consciousness, so that consciousness itself is a continuity, and that continuity, when you further investigate by three times, it's so difficult to find them. So the first the moment, if there has to be the beginning to a life, then that very first moment has to be happened either by without cause, or it has to be happened by an irrelevant cause. So therefore, it is very difficult. So it's so difficult to come to the conclusion of having the beginning of a life. And also, when we have the four reasonings, the first, the reasoning of the action, the reasoning of the dependence and reliance. So these reasonings, again, ultimately has to depend upon the very nature, natural reasoning. And even the scientists ultimately say that this is the nature of the things, and there cannot be any further explanations to this.
Chambe
So also the it's all in his comments that the compassion, usually we have the compassion that actually wish to the sentient beings, the suffering to. But we need to have the great compassion, which has the potentiality to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. So reading from page number 213, His Holiness comments that when Lord Buddha presents the four teachings on the Four Noble Truths, first he said that you have to know the suffering. And to continue the read on page number 214, the compassionate mind has the nature of wishing all suffering beings to be free from suffering. Meditate on compassion for all sentient beings, because the beings in three realms of existence are intensively tortured by three types of sufferings in various forms. The Buddha has said that the heat and other types of pain constantly torture beings in the hells for a very long time. He has also said that hungry ghosts are scorched by hunger and thirst and experience immense physical suffering. We can also see animals suffering in very miserable ways. His Holiness comments that when it comes to the first level of suffering, that is the suffering upon suffering that we can see in our daily life, and to be clear of that suffering, first we have to generate the compassion that has the potential to liberate sentient beings from the first level of suffering. And about the 7 billion people in this world and also the animals on this planet, of course there is nothing we can do much about the animals that are suffering. So if you do not have some power or authority from yourself, there is nothing that we can do to benefit the number of the sentient beings and the animals on this world. So those who are really under the suffering, or those who are taking the causes of suffering and embarrassing these causes of sufferings, which will in turn suffer in times to come. So gods, to continue reading, gods suffer the misery of change, for example, signs of impending death, and therefore, unfortunate states constantly oppress the minds of gods of desire realm. How can they live in peace? Pervasive misery is what arises under the power of causes, characterized by actions and disturbing emotions. His Holiness comments that all the compounded phenomena usually changes by moment and moment, but as the Dhammakriti presents that by the order of the impermanence, and then comes the suffering. So this impermanence is usually the impermanence under the influence of the cause and effect. Karma and afflicted emotions. To continue reading, therefore, seeing all wandering beings as immersed in a great fire of misery, think that they are all like you in not desiring misery at all. Alas, all my beloved sentient beings are in such pain. What can I do to set them free and make their sufferings your own? Whether you are engaged in one-pointed meditation or perceiving your ordinary activities, His Holiness comments that when we have these two sessions, the on sessions and the between the sessions, so whatever you have meditated during the main session, so we have to continue that practice in our in between the sessions or at the time of interval. Continue reading. Begin by meditating on your friends and the relatives. Recognize how they experience the various sufferings that have been explained. Then, having seen all sentient beings as equal, with no difference between them, you should meditate on sentient beings to whom you are indifferent. When the compassion you feel towards them is the same as the compassion you feel toward your friends and relatives, meditate on compassion for all sentient beings throughout the 10 directions of the universe. Just as a mother responds to her small, beloved, and suffering child, when you develop a spontaneous and equal sense of compassion towards all sentient beings, you have perfected the practice of compassion. So this is the measure of generating the compassion. And this is known as great compassion. And this is what I was speaking about, the compassion which is not contaminated, which is not related to attachment. Continue reading. Meditation on loving-kindness begins with friends and people you are fond of. It is the nature of wishing that they meet with happiness. Gradually extend the meditation to include strangers and even your enemies. Habituating yourself with compassion, you will gradually generate a spontaneous wish to liberate all sentient beings. Therefore, having familiarized yourself with compassion as the basis, meditate on the awakening mind of Bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is of two types, conventional and ultimate. Conventional bodhicitta is the cultivation of the initial thought. So till here, we have completed the generation of the conventional bodhicitta. And the next, to training mind of the seven-point cause and effect and exchange of self and other. And Nagarjuna, through his the precious Scarlet text, so they consider the practice of equalizing and exchanging of self and other has been considered prominent. And as the verse come that, as the prayers in the precious garland reads that, so even we can take, we can generate the bodhicitta mind through these verses. And I also do not remember the verses from the commentary to the bodhicitta mind, the text by Nagarjuna, but this is very effective verse. So the training of the mind by the exchanging of the self and other, so what the essence which is presented by Nagarjuna is actually the Shantideva's, the guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life. And Kunalama Rinpoche told me that I think it was in the 8th century that the Shantideva composed these texts. And from that time till now, so there is not any other text or the practitioners which presents the practice of the bodhicitta more clearer. And this, in this text, actually, the benefits of the other concerned mind and the negativities of the self-centered feelings are presented and grounded with different reasonings. And also, when these two reasonings are compared, the self-centered is really resorted to such a side that it cannot speak anything. So now we are to the Shantideva's text, Sanskrit Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, Tibetan Chanchusimbe Chobala Chubha, homage to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Respectfully, I prostrate myself to the Sugatas who are endowed with the Dhammakaya. So His Holiness comments that when we speak about the Bodhisattva Charya, so usually when we speak about engaging, so engaging can be of different things. The engaging is about usually attainment of the Buddhist state. as well as their noble sons, and to all who are worthy of veneration. Here I shall explain how to engage in the vows of Buddha's son, the meaning of which I've contents in accordance with the scriptures. So this, the pledge to compose is actually similar to Dhammakriti's Pramana Vartika, where the Dhammakriti says that he do not have any expectations. He do not have any expectations that the compose of my text will be of any benefit to those people who are under the influence of attachment, hatred, and so on. And Kunalama Rinpoche told me that there is a different translation of the one vote. And the verse number 2, there is nothing here that has not been explained before, and I have no skill in the art of rhetoric. Therefore, lacking any intention to benefit others, I write this in order to acquaint it to my mind. And usually at this point, I read from the 9th chapter, the chapter on wisdom. So please look at the Bishan of 198. The first verse, the sage propounded all these branches of teachings for the sake of wisdom. Therefore, those who wish to pacify suffering should generate wisdom. And as we discuss about, it's on page number 148. We discuss about the 10 different instructions, that the first instructions on the two truths and the four truths and so on. And Nagarjuna also says that all the teachings of the Buddha has to be grounded on the presentation of the two truths. So the real essence and the prime teachings of the Buddha, which is actually the teaching to attain the enlightenment, is the teaching on the two truths. Because the main the main obscuration to attain enlightenment is actually the grasping of true existence. And in order to eliminate that obscuration, we need to understand the true truths, especially the emptiness. And other than that, when it comes to the practice of impermanence and so on, and especially the Guru Yoga deities and so on, we can even find in the non-Buddhist and all other traditions. So the real demarcation and real teachings or the presentation that brings a clear demarcation between the Buddhists and the non-Buddhists has to be the teaching which is grounded in the true truths. So the one, usually we have this demarcation about the four seal, those who accept that all compounded phenomena are by nature impermanent, and all the contaminated phenomena are sufferings, and all phenomena are empty and no self. So these four seals, those who accept this four seal, are considered as Buddhist. The second verse reads, conventional and ultimate, these are accepted as being the two truths. The ultimate is not the object of mind. The mind is spoken of the conventional. So when we speak about the true truths, so truth here is about the difference between the appearance and reality. This is also spoken by the scientists. In the quantum physics, usually, of course, it is about the matter. When you probe further about the different particles, the atoms, and so on, so there is, they could not find anything when it is subjected to further analysis in finding a reality of the matter. So the scientists understand that those physicists can really confirm that the matter, those forms and the matters do not really have have a solid existence for themselves. So therefore, this all reality are actually in relation to the observer. So the external appearances of the matter and those external atoms and the phenomena exist as long as there is an observer. And when the observer ceases to exist, the matter also does not exist. And this is also similar to the mind-only school's presentation that the mind and the external, the phenomena are happened by one's realizing the same, the karma. And one of my friend who is normal, an intern friend, he said that the quantum physics is actually idea is quite a new one in the Western world, but this is very old in Indian tradition because he saw a similar one in the one of the works of Nagarjuna. And till now, the scientist never speaks about the mind or consciousness. And at the end of the 20th century, some of the scientists, especially the neurologists, were, after further research and experiments, they think that there is something which gives an extra power or strength to the brain, which is actually not brain. And secondly, by training one's mind, by the benefit of the training the minds, there can be some changes in the brain's activities. And also the health, from the health point of view, we can come to the point that if one is in a disturbed mind, the happiness of that person is disturbed. So what I'm saying here is that so the scientists, when it comes to the external matter, they can really confirm and establish that these things do not have intrinsic persons. But they do not use the same terminology of the designations and so on. But they speak about an observer. And when it comes to the observer, till now they haven't paid any interest about the self or the person. So till now they speak about soul. And in the non-Buddhist, they speak about Atma, which is very different from the aggregates and which is not rely upon the aggregates. And now gradually, that tradition which investigate the inner mind is only the Buddhism. The middle stage of meditation, when they present the view, of course, they do accept about phenomena defined by self, one's own characteristic. But the view which is presented, when it is presented by Shantideva's text, they do not accept any phenomena that do have its own sense of characteristics. So there is a difference, of course, in these two texts. And also, these texts are actually based, the Shantideva's text is actually based on the highest Madhyamika school, Madhyamika Prasangika school, while the stages of meditation is based on Madhyamika Swatantrika school, which accept and conventionally the phenomena characterized by its own features. So first, in order to generate the wisdom realizing the ultimate, we have to understand what is ultimate here, what does we meant by ultimate truth. And that can be possible only by investigations and experimenting the very nature or reality of these things, and that the real nature of the reality of any phenomena that cannot be found upon further investigation is called the ultimate truth. As Again, this has to be backed by the understanding that these natures are neither cannot be happened by without cause or irrelevant cause and so on, as we have discussed, we have seen in our salutation verses. And when it comes to, as it is presented by the fundamental wisdom about the eight different modes of finding the reality. In a conventional way, we have this conventionally terminology such as one and multiple, the self is one and multiple with the aggregates. But when it is subject to critical investigation, it cannot be found. And these things, when they are subjected to critical analysis by reasoning, such as the four modes of eliminating all the four alternatives, reasoning and so on, so nothing can be found. Nothing can be found after such experiments. So therefore, it says things do not arise and things do not cease and so on. So that's, it reads the second verse, conventional and ultimate. These are accepted as being the two truths. And here the third line says, the ultimate is not the object of mind. So His Holiness comments that the ultimate truth, as we usually refer to about the things that appear to our mind, so ultimate truth is not something can be found by that kind of the wisdom or the mind that usually deals with the conventional phenomena. So the ultimate here means not being satisfied by merely the appearance, but that wills to further investigate the nature through investigation. So then what can we find after subjecting to critical analysis? Then there is nothing to be found. And at the time of our elementary classes, we study about the positive and the negative phenomena. And the emptiness here is a negative phenomena. So negative is also have two classifications. So then there is a sense of the empty that when you further investigate deeply, there is nothing that you can find, that nothingness or the absence of intrinsic is what we call the ultimate truth. So if you, when you cannot find the things, when subject them to these investigations, so then if you come to the thought that this do not exist, then it will be again, there will be critics by the valid cognitions from the conventionalities. So therefore, so things do not have intrinsic reality, but they do have an existence, which is by a conventional reality or by the popularities, as it is known in the world. So this, we have to really be familiar with such kind of understanding for in the long term. So if we contemplate further and for a longer time, there will be a potential to eliminate the two extremisms. So this is as a part of introducing the Buddha's teaching. So back to the first chapter.
So in Buddhism, we talk about the two truths. So within the realm of the conventional truth, we have the suffering which comes as a result of our holding, grasping at some true existence, which gives rise to the mental construction, the where we have the different the inappropriate mentation, and that gives rise to karma and the delusions, and then karma. And so, according to the law of causality, we have the three poisons in the center.
In the outer circle of this 12 links of dependent origination, there are those 12 links beginning with ignorance and ending with death and decay, and that inside that circle are the six realms of existence, and within that circle are two a circle which is cut into two halves, one white and one black, representing the higher realms and the lower realms, and then in the center are the three animals depicting, which symbolize the ignorance, represented by or symbolized by the pig, and then from the ignorance comes out, this pig comes out, those of the bird and the snake, which represent or symbolize their attachment and the anger or hatred. And so how do we go about in this cycle of existence is through the 12 links of dependent origination. And so dependent origination, within that 12 links, we have the ignorance represented by an old blind lady. And so regarding ignorance, so there is a mere not knowing something, and also another ignorance, which is a distorted way of seeing things. And so the distorted view or distorted ignorance is the main cause of our negative emotions and so forth. So this becomes the fundamental ignorance in direct cause, and then we have ignorance about law of causality, due to which we create the negative karmas, which actually propels us into the cycle of existence. And so if you are a caretaker of a monastery or a temple, if you could actually explain this teaching in this way, represented by this the wheel of life, it would be really helpful. Otherwise, we have the other four guardians of in the four quarters of the world as represented by the four kings. That may not be of much help. In Seramir, in Tibet, there was a temple which is called the Sunny Temple. And so there is a statue of a Cho, which was the caretaker of the temple, said to me that it was brought from India. And why this temple was given the name Sunny Temple was, he said, because this statue of the Buddha came from India, and it has actually said it didn't need any high temple or a low temple, but a temple which is warm and sunny, and so that's why it got this name. So that doesn't really help in introducing teaching of the Buddha to others. So rather than that, if we could describe the wheel of life to others, how, according to teaching of the Buddha, we go around and in this recycle in this the samsara due to ignorance, giving right. And then, of course, we need to, when we think about bodhicitta, spirit of enlightenment, without some spirit, intelligence and wisdom, how can we actually understand and explain bodhicitta to others? So in order to, of course, we may do some, to a certain extent, we may be able to practice the bodhicitta, but in order to have a real good way of practicing bodhicitta, we should use use intelligence. And so, therefore, the text goes through the higher realm, or the fortunate realm, leisure and endowments, are very hard to find, and since they accomplish what is meaningful for man or beings, if I do not take advantage of them now, how will such an opportunity come about again? And so at this time when you have found this human, precious human life, what the Buddha's teaching says is that this root of suffering is within our mind, which is that of the ignorance and the negative emotions and so forth, this undisciplined mind. So this kind of human life is very difficult to find again and again, because things are dependent on their causes and conditions. Good and bad results come from good and bad causes. Bad causes cannot give rise to bad good results, and good causes cannot give rise to bad results. But the results, good or bad, come from the compatible causes, good or bad. Just as a flash of lightning on a dark, cloudy night brightly illuminates all. Likewise, in this world, through the might of the Buddha, a wholesome thought rarely and briefly appears. So we got into the Prasangika Madhyamaka, which doesn't assert or accept any objective existence in things, even in convention. But when we see things, we do have this appearance, that we do have this perception that things have some objective existence, and therefore we believe that things do exist that way, and therefore the mind is enshrouded in this thick or dense darkness, as Master Tsongkhapa says. And things, if you think through, you'll find that things do not exist the way they appear. And then if you acquaint your mind with this understanding and idea, and then you'll be able to see that things are like illusion. They appear in a certain way, but you confirm that they do not exist that way. And so acquainting your mind this, so just as it is said that when we see the images of the Buddhas and so forth, there is some subtle attachment and so forth. So with regard to negative emotions, there are those of the negative emotions according to the lower schools of thought, which are based on the idea that there is objective existence in things. And according to the Prasangika Madhyamaka, since there is no objective existence in whatever, but we still hold on to that kind of existence. So there is a subtle kind of ignorance. And according to Chandrakirti's clear word, Prasannapada commentary, it mentions that there are certain negative emotions which arise in dependence on this ignorance, the distorted ignorance. And then he also says that these are the gross forms of the negative emotions, whereas there are certain negative emotions or disturbing emotions which are concomitant with, which go together with the grasping at true existence, and those are the subtle ones. And so as your mind, you acquaint your mind with the emptiness more and more, then you will be able to overcome the subtle negative emotions gradually as well. So to have a physical body and the mental basis and physical basis to practice bodhicitta, and this is what the text says. Hence, virtue is perpetually feeble, the great strength of evil being extremely intense, and except for fully awakening mind, by what other virtue will it be overcome? And the next verse. So regarding, I mean, as far as we are concerned, we are more or less obsessed with the causes of suffering, those of the destructive emotions. And we don't see these negative emotions as something negative or the faulty. Whereas in even in the case of the non-Buddhist traditions, for example, there are the practitioners who find the negative emotions that fall within the desire realm to be disadvantages and the higher realms to be more peaceful, and accordingly they cultivate the single-pointed concentration leading to the higher realms. And one time I was invited to a temple, a Jain temple, and at the ceremony, the Jain master was sitting next to me, and he was really sincere practitioner. So, of course, they practice humility, moderation, and the non-violence. And so he was not bothered by being naked at all. And so since he was next to me, I actually felt inspired, and I touched my head to his knee. So they do practices to curb the negative emotions that arise in relation to the sensual objects, and try to cultivate the higher, I mean, more deeper, higher or paths. So I forgot where I was. All Buddhas who have contemplated. The hands virtue is perpetually feeble. The great strength of evil being extremely intense. So there are some non-Buddhist traditions which actually consider the destructive emotions to be disadvantages and faulty. Otherwise, in the world, if you look at the world, there are very few who actually see the negative emotions to be faulty. And it is only in the Indian traditions that negative emotions are seen as faulty, whereas in those theistic religions, religions which believe in the Creator God, they emphasize the practice of faith to bear faith and conviction in God, whereas and then accordingly deal with the disturbing emotions, and in the Indian traditions also they do so. So those traditions, religious traditions and thoughts which see negative emotions to be faulty are within the Indian tradition, and particularly the teaching of the Buddha, and specifically the system of Nagarjuna, which sees the grasping at true existence to be the ultimate root of all our negative emotions and suffering and so forth. So except for the fully awakening mind, what other virtue will it be overcome, it says. So bodhicitta is that factor which can counter the negative emotions within ourselves. As Maitreya says, bodhicitta helps us and leads us to avoid negative the lower realms, and leads us to higher realms and to the deathless state. And usually we think of the avoiding negative actions because it helps, it is bad for us. But the bodhicitta spirit, I mean, with the bodhicitta spirit, what you think is that if I do something negative, it actually harms others. So this is more powerful than being, I mean, avoiding negative actions with a selfish motive, where you, and therefore, here you are thinking others to be more important than oneself and to cherish others over oneself. And so when you consider others more important than oneself, it, you naturally avoid the non-virtuous karmas and actions, just killing, stealing, and so forth. And then avoiding these negative actions, you create the positive karmas which lead you to the higher realms of existence. So I can guarantee that if you practice bodhicitta, the spirit of enlightenment, and the wisdom of emptiness, you will have a higher rebirth, a fortunate rebirth in the next life. So the elderly people, of course, you can recite bodhicitta, recite different mantras, Om Mani Padme Hum, and so forth. But if you reflect on and try to develop bodhicitta, the spirit of enlightenment and the wisdom of emptiness, it will help you from life after life, lifetime to lifetime. And therefore, both the Master Chandideva says in this particular text that if you do not exchange your own happiness and joy with the suffering of others, how? I mean, leave alone attaining Buddhahood, even in samsara, you'll not have happiness. And therefore, within this context, he says, which intelligent person would actually feel discouraged to ride the horse of bodhicitta, which leads one from bliss to bliss and does away with despair. And therefore, if you could practice and cultivate bodhicitta within yourself, cherishing others over oneself, and you can actually dedicate yourself to for the well-being of others for eons and eons, however long it takes to reach enlightenment, your prayer would be, as long as space endures, as long as space suspension beings remain, may I too remain in order to dispel the suffering of the transmigratory beings. Sometimes we have the attitude that if you are more compassionate, it helps others but not yourself. And thinking that giving up yourself means literally not doing anything for yourself. But that's not the case. If you consider cherish others over one's own self, then you actually benefit in the end. The Shravakas and particular Buddha practitioners actually think of themselves alone to reach that of nirvana, but they are not able to help others infinitely, whereas the Buddhas are able to help others infinitely because of the bodhicitta, and therefore to be wisely selfish is to cultivate bodhicitta. And therefore, all the Buddhas who have contemplated it for many eons have seen it to be beneficial. Verse number 7. So the Buddhas of the past and the present, such as the Buddha Shakyamuni of the present era, became Buddhas because of the practice of bodhicitta itself. And the future Buddhas will become enlightened on the basis of this practice of bodhicitta. For by it, the limitless masses of beings will quickly attain the supreme state of bliss. The first of the chapter is the benefit of bodhicitta. There are 10 chapters in it, this text. I mean, if you could think of the pros and cons of meditating on emptiness, I mean, of bodhicitta, sorry, I mean, you will be able to inspire yourself to develop bodhicitta. And therefore, the first chapter is the benefit of bodhicitta in awakening mind, and then the disclosure of evil or confession. And then in order to accumulate merit, you have the third chapter, fully accepting awakening. And then conscientiousness and guarding alertness to purify your moral practice, and then enthusiasm, patience and enthusiasm, and meditation, chapter on the meditation, which teaches that of the exchanging, equaling and exchanging self and others. And so when it comes to this practice, the topics dealt with in patience chapter 6 really is important to help us face the challenges in our process of developing bodhicitta, where we face lots of obstacles. And so this up to seventh chapter, lays the good foundation, firm foundation for the development of bodhicitta. And then in the eighth chapter, we come across the bodhicitta. And within it is the meditation also. And because we have this kind of a body, which is a result of our karma and delusions, and we need to take care of it. And therefore, in the practice of cultivating bodhicitta, when you feel tired, you should take rest. This is what Chandideva teaches us in this chapter. And therefore, we need to take care of this body until we gain some mastery over the internal energies. I mean, we must take care of our the body. And therefore, this chapter emphasizes the bodhicitta, including in exchanging self and others. And then the first chapter is about the benefit of bodhicitta. So those who wish to, oneself who wishes to destroy the many sorrows of conditioned existence, the sorrows of or the suffering of the cyclic existence comes as a result of our self-cherishing attitude and grasping at true existence, which actually work hand in hand, and they have actually resided in the core of our heart, and as a result of that, we are where we are now, in this pathetic condition. So, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas saw this to be faulty and disadvantageous, and therefore cultivated bodhicitta, which counters the self-cherishing attitude, and the wisdom realizing emptiness, which counters our grasping at some true independent existence. And therefore, if you really want to combat these two negative attitudes, you must develop these two principles of bodhicitta and wisdom. And this is what the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have done. And therefore, you need to cultivate bodhicitta, this as the altruistic attitude, with wisdom to help others. And those who wish to, all beings to experience a multitude of joys, and those who wish to experience much happiness, should never forsake the awakening mind. And so those who wish to overcome the sorrows, many sorrows of the cycling existence, and experience multitude of joy and also experience much happiness, must cultivate bodhicitta, the awakening mind. Verse number 8, I'm going to stop here. So on a daily basis, after my teaching, please read the text and try to go over and try to reflect on what I have explained, and so that you could do this kind of a screening kind of meditation, as usually we have the certain traditions where the disciples actually go over the teaching and reflect and remind themselves. And so the bodhicitta is teaching the essence of the teaching of the Buddha. And even if the Buddha were to come today, he would not have any other teaching more important than this. And therefore, since we have printed this book, particularly for this teaching, and please read them and then reflect, remind yourself of what I have explained. And you could also ask your friends, if you don't remember, to remind and then help each other and keep the teachings in mind so that you don't forget and be mindful of the teaching. Not only that, you should also acquaint your mind with the teaching over and over again. Perhaps I could say this, there's nothing wrong in saying this, but I'm not boasting. Regarding myself, I must have accumulated merit in the past life, but even then, I could have experienced, I've been able to have the experience of bodhicitta and the wisdom of emptiness. By thinking over these and cultivating it over 40, 60 years. And so you should also put effort in reflecting and being mindful and familiarizing your mind with these two principles. And don't feel discouraged that you are not able to develop bodhicitta and the wisdom of emptiness right away, even if you are not able to develop them right away. Our great masters of the past, such as Kedrup Norsan Gyatso and Gewa Ensapa and so forth, really put effort in, not in a short period of time, but over a long period of time, 40 years and more. And Kedrup Norsan Gyatso was someone, according to the second Dalai Lama Gendun Gyatso, that he was someone who was nearly reaching that of the Buddhahood, Vajradhara state. So he worked and studied and practiced for over 40 years. And so we should also put effort. There's no other way we could actually find other than putting effort and not complaining. Otherwise, if you don't want to cultivate bodhicitta, you should go on complaining about this life being full of problems, troubles, and so forth. So if you don't want to complain about this, about negative emotions and so forth, and want to actually counter them, overcome them, then there's no other way than reading this book and reflecting on the teaching and cultivating the path within yourself to counter these negative emotions within ourselves, yourselves. As the Kadamba master says, that even if I'm old, they say, even if you're an old person not being able to chew on your food well, you will practice, do your best. Do you agree with me or not?
No.
Do you want to nod or do you want to say yes, nodding, and or shake your head saying no?
Geba